The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in the Buddha's instructions to us, in some places in the suttas, he encourages us to see experience as it actually is, to recognize what's happening in the mind, in the body, as phenomena that is happening in the mind and body. I talked about this a little bit last night at the talk last night, that the perspective of mindfulness, of right mindfulness, is to understand and recognize that what's happening in the present moment is a phenomenon happening in the present moment. So we know seeing as happening in the present moment. We know hearing as something happening in the present moment. We know thoughts arising in the mind as something happening in the present moment. So we orient towards this, sometimes this perspective, it's called bare attention, to orient towards just knowing what's happening in the present moment as what's happening in the present moment. But we don't usually live our lives this way. Instead, we tend to add to experience. We add liking and not liking, we add reactions, we add opinions, ideas, agendas. And a lot of where we struggle in our lives come from this adding to our experience. So I'd like to explore different ways that we add to experience to talk about that this morning. One of the key ways that we add to experience often has to do with whatever's happening is happening in the present moment. There's sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and things going on in the mind. And we tend to like certain things and not like other things. We like things to be pleasant. We don't like things to be unpleasant. And that very liking and not liking is a little bit of adding, even just that piece of liking something and not liking other things is a little bit of adding. Now, it's very natural to like the pleasant, to not like the unpleasant. So I'm not saying that, you know, we have to stop that, but to begin to recognize that liking is something that the mind is doing that's extra. That it's not, I mean, like for instance, we might have some food laid out on a table and five people in the room, each tasting the same food. Some people will like it, some people will be kind of neutral about it, and some people won't like it. Same food, just landing in different ways. And so we can even recognize from this kind of example that the liking is not inherent in what's out there. You know, it is dependent on conditions. It's dependent perhaps on the food that we were given as a child, what we've become accustomed to, what we have acquired a taste for, perhaps. And so some people will have an experience of pleasantness or unpleasantness about the food and then will like or not like it. And so the liking, the not liking, is not inherent in what's going on. It's something related to our own experience, our own conditioning. So we experience phenomenon, we experience things, and then we have this beginning of a response to it. It's helpful to begin to know what we add, to begin to recognize, okay, this this liking is not inherent in what's there. It's, this is what's happening in this mind and body right now. Liking is happening right now. Or not liking is happening right now. What happens to you if you begin to notice that? That simple adding of liking and not liking. Often if we don't notice the simplicity, the simple movement of liking and not liking, our minds will begin to kind of charge out around the liking or not liking, begin to have even more responses, more additions to what's going on. So we have the not liking of something, and then maybe a kind of a, oh, outright aversion, and maybe some, you know, with the food on the table analogy, it's like, you know, we put something in our mouth, we don't like it, and then we start having stories about it. We wonder why they even chose to put it on the table, and we have judgments, opinions, and views about that. So there's an aversion, perhaps, maybe even an anger, you know, of, I remember at one point I was at a friend's house for lunch and they served a salad. And I had just recently come to California and lived on the East Coast for much of my life. And in my family, we served iceberg lettuce. And, you know, the iceberg lettuce has a lot of crunch to it. Not a lot of flavor, but it's got a lot of crunch and water to it. And that was what I had grown up eating. And my California friends, I just moved to California, they served this very, you know, like greens, you know, the kind of California greens salad. And the thought in my mind, this was before I ever started to practice, but I still remember that this thought came up in my mind. It's like, don't they know that I don't like that kind of lettuce? You know, just this kind of reaction. It's like, this is completely extra. It's completely extra that, first of all, that I would pick up that idea of, you know, my view being kind of the center of the universe. So we have these likings and not likings, and tend to carry those further. So we add out reactivity to liking and not liking. Liking and not liking is itself a very subtle form of leaning, I would say. You know, it's a subtle form of leaning, a preferring and not preferring, and actually preferring may be a little subtler even than liking and not liking. So, you know, we lean towards things we like, and then we want more of them. We grab onto them. We lean away from things we don't like. We move into aversion, or even as much as anger or irritation or frustration when things are not the way we like them. So, you know, often we don't simply stop with liking and not liking. I got mildly irritated. You know, it's like, did I have to get irritated over lettuce? I mean, it's kind of remarkable thinking back on it that the mind picked that up and decided to become irritated about it. So, you know, the extra that we add is a lot of where our minds struggle and our minds suffer. So this process, you know, we can begin by being curious about what's actually going on. You know, when there is liking or not liking, when there is kind of a reactivity, you know, if there's a liking, usually there's something pleasant in our experience. If there's a not liking, usually there's something unpleasant in our experience. And so as we notice liking and not liking, things as they are, as they actually are, well, there's liking and not liking arising in the mind, but they're arising in dependence on something else. Some sight, some sound, some smell, some taste, some touch, some mood, some thought. So what is it that is being liked? What is it that is not being liked? And can you begin to touch into, oh, that not liking is because this mind and body find that unpleasant. This liking is because this mind and body find that pleasant. So we kind of can take a step back to what's actually happening in the present moment around sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and the the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of that experience. That place of noticing the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral quality to our experience is a place the Buddha highlighted in his teaching around how suffering is constructed in our minds. That the moment we are not mindful of this kind of bare level of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we move into reactivity. And that is where suffering begins. So we start to be curious. If we can start to be curious, if there's a reaction happening, we're not going to probably be able to turn off the reaction and say, stop reacting, stop being averse to this lettuce. But we might be able to be curious, what's actually happening here? What's actually unpleasant that the mind is not liking this? So this is an exploration that we can potentially begin to engage in. When there's something, a kind of reactivity happening, if there's a struggle happening, being curious, if it's a kind of an aversive reaction, there's something unpleasant in the experience that may not be clearly known. When there's a kind of a reaction of wanting to hold on to something, to be greedy about something, then there's something pleasant happening. You know, what is it that you're leaning towards? What is it that you're leaning away from? The simple exploration can be quite revealing. So if I go back to that lettuce example, I mean, this was so long ago, I'm kind of speculating a little bit about what was going on there. But what my guess is that was what was happening is that there was a mild, maybe, disappointment or a little bit of lack of what I was expecting in a salad, that crunchy, watery taste. And the flavor was unfamiliar. Probably it wasn't that unpleasant. Maybe it was just more unexpected. So there was a little bit maybe of unpleasantness around the flavor. Maybe. But if I'm really honest, probably it was not even unpleasant taste in the lettuce that they served. What was going on was an idea in the mind. Don't they know that I like this other kind of lettuce? And some idea that it should be another way. That was really unpleasant. That idea was unpleasant. So it's kind of interesting when we start to look into a reaction, something even as simple as, don't they know? Or, you know, a kind of a mild irritation or frustration. What is actually being reacted to? Where is the frustration arising from? In this case, my guess is it probably wasn't so much the actual taste of the lettuce, but it was from an idea in the mind. This can be quite humbling and illuminating for us to recognize that much of what we react to in the world is less about the sights, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, the touches, and more about what our ideas about those sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches. So we can begin to check into that as we begin to explore this reactivity. As we look at our reactivity, we see, you know, as we get curious about the reactivity itself, I mean, the teaching of notice what's arising as it actually is includes noticing the arising of reactivity. So Something happens, we experience something, we like it, we don't like it, we react to it. That reaction has arisen. It has happened in our minds. And the teaching around this exploration of noticing things as they actually are is not limited to the five senses. It also includes noticing as it actually is what's arising in the mind. Now, this gets a little more interesting and subtle. Sometimes it's a little harder to begin to recognize that. But when something like frustration arises in the mind, there's different relationships we can have to that. We might recognize, as it actually is, this is the experience of frustration arising in the mind. This experience of frustration is unpleasant. That would be knowing frustration arising as it actually is. It is a phenomenon arising in the mind. It's conditioned based on not liking something, feeling that the mind wanted it to go another way. So there's conditions for that arising of the frustration. I lost my thought. Let's see. So as we begin to notice even things like reactivity as something simply arising, that's one way that we can know it as it actually is. Our habitual way of meeting that experience is more to get involved with the frustration, to try to figure out, how do I get what I want? That is believing. That is more the believing the frustration. It's like, this frustration means I need to do something. It means I need to figure something out, get rid of something, change something. So that's kind of a buying into the frustration, a following on of the frustration. Not seeing frustration as a phenomenon, as this is the human experience of frustration. And this is really the turning of wise mindfulness, that we explore what is the human experience of what's happening right now. So this is that pointing to understanding as it actually is, understanding what's arising. So we can begin to notice our reactivity also as, this is what's arising. So as we begin to look at all of our experience, we might think, what it means to not be reactive would be simply to know kind of at the bare level everything that's happening in my sense field. But we are going to react. And so the practice of noticing what's happening includes what's happening in our minds, our reactions themselves. As we turn to that, as we actually look at the human experience of frustration, of reactivity, we see it too is unpleasant. And often because of that, there's a further not liking of it. So we react to the reaction. If we can simply explore, this experience of frustration feels unpleasant right now, we begin to understand something important about reactive states of mind, and that is that they don't serve us very well. Our habitual perspective on reactive states of mind. And, even as we, many of us might not think, yes, frustration actually serves me, but the way we behave around frustration thinks it is serving us in some way. Frustration thinks it's helping us to get what we want. So our minds buy into the stories of our reactive emotions. As they do that, as our minds think something like, frustration, I need to follow that. I need to figure this out. I need to fix this. I need to change that. We are missing, in our moment-to-moment experience, we're missing the fact that frustration actually hurts right now. This was a real revelation to me as I began turning towards my reactive states in my direct experience to see that these states of anger, of frustration, of irritation, my mind tended towards those aversive states. As we experience those, we are suffering here in the moment. And so we begin to learn by this curiosity around what is this experience of reactivity? We begin to learn that the reactivity is not something that that serves us, that is something that supports a movement towards well-being, towards ease and peace. It's definitely not serving well-being and ease and peace in this moment to be experiencing that reactivity. Our minds may believe that it serves us somehow in the future to have moments of ease and peace, that this frustration, if I can only fix the world, that this frustration will, in that future moment, when I have fixed the world, lead me to a place of ease and peace. That's the belief that we have bought into as we follow these reactive states. And so essentially, the reactive mind is willing to forego ease and peace here and now for the possibility of some moment of ease and peace in the future. And yet in the very process of foregoing that ease and peace now, we are cultivating the likelihood that by the time we get to that future moment, what's going to happen is that there'll be something else that we are reacting to, something else that is not quite right with the world. Well, gosh, I arranged things here, but now there's this thing that's a problem. Oh, I better fix that. And so we're continually tumbling forward, continually operating from these reactive places and foregoing that ease and peace that might be possible here and now. And so the way the Buddha proposed to us, and it's not easy medicine, to turn towards what we're adding, turn towards that reactivity, and see how it makes this human being feel in this moment, at this time. It'll very quickly become clear that it's not helpful. Now, I always have to bring in, often when there's reactivity to something in the world, there are things that, it's not that we are, just becoming these non-responsive beings as we let go of reactivity. The letting go of reactivity takes us to a place where we are not kind of knee-jerk reacting to experience. But we also, as the reactivity begins to diminish, we open into a heart that's more responsive, can feel into what's happening in the world with a little bit more discernment rather than that automatic reaction. And when the reactivity begins to diminish, what comes to the fore is not non-responsiveness, but wise responsiveness. A skillful response, an appropriate response. And so the lessening of reactivity doesn't mean that we become blobs, that we become these indifferent beings. Actually, what I find is the more my heart opens, the less reactivity there is. Like the heart of reactivity feels tight, feels constricted, feels like it has like walls around it. It's not able to receive what's happening in the world so easily. It's defended. It's got barriers. As those barriers fall away, the heart becomes more sensitive. It more experiences and feels the suffering of the world. But it doesn't shatter with that suffering. It more resonates and wants to respond with compassion. When that heart feels into someone experiencing joy and delight, again, that heart resonates with that. And so as reactivity begins to diminish, actually what I find is that the heart feels more fully. So as we explore this side of what we add around reactivity, you know, that kind of knee-jerk reaction of liking, not liking, aversion, greed, more extreme responses, the very exploration of that begins to head us in the direction of releasing that reactivity. It's counterintuitive. When I first started practicing with mindfulness of my reactivity, it was not clear to me how it would serve to let go of reactivity, to pay attention to reactivity, to be mindful of it. But it is this shift of perspective. It's this curiosity of what is the human experience of this reactivity that we are noticing, not our kind of familiar perspective or our habitual perspective of, oh, there's this reactivity, what do I need to do about it? So taking the attention and turning the attention towards the human experience rather than what do I need to do about this? And as the reactivity falls away, there's the what do I need to do about it becomes more of a natural response that rather than a mental reaction. The heart that has let go of reactivity has a very natural resonance and response to the world. And each being, each person will have a different way of manifesting that. It's not that everybody would manifest that in the same way. It's not that everybody would do the same things in the world with a heart that meets suffering. But a heart that's meeting the world with hatred and aversion and desire to hold on to things for me, 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 that heart is not so responsive, is not so able to take in the kind of the bigger picture of the world. It takes time to let go of this reactivity, to explore this. Looking at what we add, you know, as we start to see, I mean, as we start to feel into the suffering of our reactivity, often, as I said, you know, we can have a reaction to that because it's like we see it over and over again, and we think, shouldn't it be done by now? I mean, I've been watching impatience for weeks, you know, shouldn't it be over by now? These habits, these patterns of mind are so conditioned. We've been practicing them for years, if not lifetimes. And so the unwinding of that, using this perspective, I think last night I used this analogy of mindfulness almost as a solvent. It's like a very gentle, warm bath in which things can release and relax. But, you know, you put something into that gentle, warm bath and it doesn't, like, release immediately. The old habits, the old patterns continue. There's an analogy. I like to use this analogy. Some of you have probably heard me use this one before. The Buddha offered around the practice and the gradual nature of the way things release in our hearts, that we bring our mindful attention to whatever's happening right now. Anger, confusion, frustration, pride, arrogance. We turn our attention to that, and over time, through the recognition of, oh, this hurts, this is painful, this is how this is put together, the mind begins to weaken the fiber of that pattern, slowly over time. The analogy the Buddha used about the gradual nature of this process, he said, if there's a shipwreck, the rigging from the ship, the rope, is going to be, you know, lying on the beach. And the sun, the sand, the wind, the waves are going to be washing over that rigging. Very gradually over time, that washing and exposure to those elements will begin to weaken the fiber of the rope. But if you go back every day and, or even, you know, if we go back every hour and look at that rope, how much of it is dissolved? Every day, how much of it is dissolved? You're not going to see a difference day to day. But come back a year from now, 2 years from now, you'll see that the fiber of that rope has been slowly rotted. So this is the way our practice has this gradual nature too. No moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. It is supporting this gentle, slow wearing away of our reactivity as we turn our attention to it. And so patience is really needed for us in this practice. Patience to recognize, yeah, it's not going to go away right away. And the patience to be willing to keep looking at the same pattern. It's coming up anew each time. Each time a reaction happens, it's coming up anew. And we can, it's like each time we bring mindfulness to it, we're getting just a slightly different perspective on that pattern. We may learn something a little bit different about that pattern. We might understand this time how the pattern came up because we thought about something from the past. We might understand the next time that the pattern hurts the heart. We might understand the next time that the pattern leads us to acting in ways that are not so helpful in the world. So we begin to see all different things as we explore, or willing to explore with mindfulness, this reactivity. It's a slow process. It is well worth the time. And in my own experience around the slowness of this process, I have seen that there are moments when there's kind of almost a breakthrough in understanding. Like, just like, oh, I get it. I see something. And for that little short moment, there's a really clear understanding of why this is so helpful. And we can use those moments, because that understanding of why this is so helpful in that moment is impermanent. It is going to disappear. And we're going to get caught again. And this is another way, another habitual way that our minds work. We think when we've seen something clearly that, check, done that, figured it out, not going to happen again. I can't tell you how many times I've actually had that thought in my mind in practice. It's like, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to experience that again. That depression, that ache in the heart. Oh, I see how it's just a conditioned arising, and it's just falling away. Wow, never going to have to feel that again. Ha! No, it comes back. That moment of understanding is a kind of a moment when the mind has really clearly seen things as they are in that moment. And yet, that's a conditioned arising. So the patience is needed, first of all, to know this pattern of having seen through something clearly and then not seeing through it clearly, going back to the kind of conditioned way that we react, that is, you are not alone. You are not alone in that. I sometimes hear, you know, sometimes in talking to people about their practice, they say, I've gone backwards, or, you know, I know that I knew this at one point, and so I must not be doing it right now. And this is just the way minds work. The habitual conditioned nature of our minds is so strong. And the practice of cultivating that establishment of mindfulness and the ability to meet things with that non-judgmental, non-reactive, oh, frustration is arising right now. That's being cultivated slowly. And so sometimes the habits and patterns of our mind are stronger than our capacity to be present for them in this moment. And in those times, there will be what we will be seeing is the reactivity. This is not a problem. No moment of mindfulness is wasted. Sometimes the balance will be the other way. The mindfulness will be stronger than the pattern. Or the mindfulness happens to be present just as the pattern's beginning. So it sees it before it gets exacerbated, before it gets so strong. And the mindfulness can meet that, and we watch it fall apart. So this ebb and flow of practice is something that we need a lot of patience about. I'm just wanting to normalize that pattern for people, because the way that we learn in our practice is not kind of the same way we learn facts, that we can kind of store them and pick them up. It's a much more organic kind of reorientation of the mind. And that happens slowly, and sometimes that reorientation slips back to the old orientation. So that's one aspect of what we add. And what I think I'll do, I could go on and talk about some others right now, but I think what I'll do is I'll talk about that in a couple of weeks and just see if there's any comments or questions about what I said so far, so there can be some time for discussion this morning. Yeah.
Well, you didn't quite structure your talk in this. You didn't quite structure your presentation in quite this manner, but what seems to be coming out of it is almost like a comparison and contrast between reactivity on the one hand and responsiveness on the other hand. And so I'm that the way out of reactivity, it's almost like two ways of dealing with something, neither of which is inert.
That is true. In terms of how we respond to the world, we can respond with an open heart, with wisdom, with compassion, with love. We can respond with a contracted heart, with anger, with aversion, with pride, with arrogance, with greed. The way to move from one to the other isn't to just say, oh, I'm going to start responding. But it actually, so, you know, if this is the reactive side, this is the responsive side. The way that we explore this is to see if we can be responsive to the reaction in our mindful attention. And so it's like gently the mindfulness begins to, we have a different perspective on that reactivity than our habitual perspective. So we begin to recognize the suffering of anger. We begin to recognize that. So just as an example of anger, you know, we begin to recognize that anger isn't inherent in what's happening in the situation. It's a response in the mind. And so we start to see that. And the bringing of mindfulness to our reactivity is a form of being responsive around the reactivity itself, instead of our habitual movement, which would be follow that reactivity, feed it with our thoughts. You know, it's like, that shouldn't be happening. I need to fix this. I need to change that. I need to tell these people how not to do these things. And I need to make sure that that person never does that again. You know, so that's fueling the reactivity. And so that will just perpetuate the cycle of reactivity. This middle way that the Buddha proposes brings these two together and allows us to know. It allows the heart to be responsive in being with reactivity. You know, almost as you might with a child that's having a temper tantrum, you know, it's not so helpful to yell at the child and you know, beat them. You know, it's helpful perhaps to say, okay, let's sit down, let's take a time out, let's just let this unfold. You know, give the child some space and some support for working with that. So it's paradoxical in a way that the way to move from reactivity to responsiveness is by opening to the reactivity. Yeah.
It seems to me that the contracted heart is the heart that has overdefined expectations of the contracted heart is the one that feels the world has promised me something that it's not delivering, and then that's why it contracts. And then, but maybe what is being delivered is ultimately more, you know, will ultimately lead to more growth and happiness. But
The point that you make around the expectations kind of being the underground of why the reactivity is there, there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, there is a kind of basic reactivity that we have to stimuli being pleasant or unpleasant that we react to. It's like, you know, if we fall down and you know, bruise our knee, you know, the pain of that often is jarred against. And so there's some amount of reactivity that just comes from the bare, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience in the world. But you're right, largely, much, and as the example around the lettuce was, it's like the expectation of, shouldn't they know what kind of lettuce I like? You know, that was what was creating the problem. You know, not the actual taste of the lettuce, but the idea that somebody should have extrasensory perception and be able to read my mind and know what I want. So this is actually the next piece that I was going to talk about in terms of what we add is views, beliefs, ideas. And I'll talk about that more. I don't really have enough time to go into it now, but it is views, beliefs are a lot of what underlies what we like and don't like. It's not just about the simple pleasant, unpleasant side of things, but it's about what we're expecting, what we believe will be leading to our happiness. And so that is a very big piece of what we add, beliefs, ideas, agendas. And so sometimes I suggest that if you're experiencing suffering, I mean, so the first tool that I really suggested today is if you're experiencing some kind of struggle or reactivity, you can check in. What is actually being reacted to? And, you know, so some of it might be, well, yeah, there's this little bit of unpleasant here of the taste of the lettuce, but what's really being reacted to is the belief that somebody should know what I like. So beginning to see that, what's actually being reacted to, what's actually unpleasant in this experience. Another way in is to, when there's a kind of reactivity or when there's struggle or suffering, you can just check in. What's being believed? That's another good question to ask yourself. What's being believed? Or for your example, what's being expected? What am I expecting right now? Just to begin to reveal sometimes the ludicrous, absolutely, you know, when we articulate them to ourselves, the ludicrousness of some of our beliefs and expectations helps to pop them, helps to, like, let us let them go. I mean, it's laughable that I would think that somebody should know what kind of lettuce I liked. It's laughable. So beginning to question, okay, so what is the belief that's happening here? That's another a huge layer. It's a huge layer of what we add that creates suffering. But I'll explore that more in a couple weeks because there's a lot I can say about that. Other comments or questions? Yeah, in the back. Would you pass the mic back?
Thank you.
It is.
Thank you for that talk, which really resonated. A lot of it did my experience. Just one comment on the idea that the practice will bring us to lack of action. In my own experience, it's actually the other way around. It's that the my pattern is anxiety. Is that when it really gets strong, all of my actions are sort of like locked down.
I see.
And it is only really through sort of like looking at that pattern and asking what it is that it wants me to do. And the answer often is, you know, go, you know, lie in a hot tub and just, like, don't do anything and just, like, enjoy the comfort of the water. The prospect of doing something is terrifying. It's only by facing that and noticing that that is not useful is that, that I can actually do something.
That's a great kind of refinement of what I point to. Yes, you know, that sometimes what our reactivity does is it freezes us. Sometimes what our reactivity does is it makes us lash out. And in either case, it's a kind of an action, you know, an action of non-doing or an action of doing. And the seeing of the anxiety and that it's fear that's keeping you from acting, then what happens as you do that? Does it create the conditions for you to recognize? Again, there's expectations, there's beliefs around that as well. It's like, if I act, it will have this disastrous consequence, or if I act, somebody will think something negatively about me. And so there's beliefs around non-action as well.
Yeah, so specifically, it's a lot of the times it's sort of like, if I act and it goes wrong, then the it would be the views of the others that I'm projecting. This person should have known better.
Yes.
That he should have known that. And then this sort of, and like you say, it's a construction of things in the mind. It's not real.
That's right.
And that creates the conditions for not acting. And sort of like letting go of that attachment to other people's expectations in the future.
Yes.
That is the thing that has helped me to sort of like act.
To let go of that being frozen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a big place of navigating the world is not only our beliefs and our expectations about ourselves, but our projection of what do other people think about us. And one of the edges for us in that place is maybe people will think they should have known better. I mean, it is a construction in our mind. And yet, one of the important things around exploring beliefs is not to tell yourself, like, you know, oh, they're not thinking that. Because we don't know what they're thinking. But can it be okay if they think that or not think that? That's kind of our edge there. So I often find it helpful around beliefs to so if something is strongly being believed, it's like, you know, for me, around my own pattern of self-negativity, I often felt like I was a failure. And that would be what my mind is telling me and believing. I'm a failure. You're no good. You can't do these things. And to tell myself in that moment, oh, that's not true. I'm really okay. I can do these things. It's kind of like that's using the what we might call affirmations or something. What I've seen is that when I try to do that, it's like it runs up so strongly against what's actually happening right now is that this is being believed. And trying to bring in the other perspective, it's like it re-cements the beliefs. It's like, yeah, you're just telling me a story. You know, I don't believe you. And so that kind of movement of bringing in the opposite belief as a counteractive You know, maybe it can help sometimes, but I've often seen it actually reify and cement the belief. So what's important there is to recognize, oh, this is a belief. This is what is being believed right now. So that's a different relationship to that experience than believing it. When we believe it, it's true. When we know this is a belief that's happening right now, that's aligned with what's happening. Believing that I'm a failure is what's happening right now. The mind is aligned with what's actually happening, and yet there's a little space for the mind to recognize, oh, this is a belief. Maybe, maybe not. You know, so that it creates, it, for me at least, it doesn't have that kind of butting up against feeling when I'm trying to bring in the opposite perspective. But just, oh, this is what's being believed right now. And sometimes as we can begin to actually articulate these beliefs, like, oh, believing that I'm a failure, you know, what's the proof of that? You know, so actually recognizing that it is a belief begins to let the mind hold alternatives. So those are other explorations around beliefs. And it's time to stop. So thank you for your participation. And I did get a little bit of the beliefs in, but I will talk about that more in a couple of weeks, adding beliefs. Thank you.